Good morning. It's great to see you. I am absolutely, and I want to remind you all of this, I'm absolutely honored, and I feel very privileged to be able to be speaking with you today. I've gotten this opportunity a lot more over the summer and into the fall now, and it's something that I don't take for granted. I love being able to spend time with all of you in this way. Sharing bits and pieces from God's Word that I think are meaningful and I think can be helpful for us. And so I want you to know that I don't take that lightly, and I'm absolutely grateful to be able to stand here and do that. I want to give you an update from last week. Last week we were talking about, I was talking about in the beginning, my GA office that I share with people. And I want you to know that I did decorate a little bit. It happened. I was pressured, or peer pressured, I suppose. Everybody had their like posters and their cool things going on, and so I now have one strip of paper from one fortune cookie taped to the wall. And it said, "The fortune says you will achieve your goals." So I thought that was inspiring, but I taped it on the other side so I could reference the lucky numbers and things just in case it came up, you know. I say that, one, to give you an update, but also to point out the fact that if you haven't been to our children's wing today over here, you might notice that it looks a little different from last week. A few of our ladies here have done a fantastic job doing all of that. Gina, Chelsea, Amber, Megan, Sarah, and Madeline were up here, I know, and Tate as well. I don't want to forget Tate. We're up here helping paint and take care of that. And many more have been involved in the process of changing some things back there and making it look good. So we're very, very grateful for y'all's work because if I were in charge of it, again, there would just be fortune cookie papers taped up all over the children's wing. But it would be very inspiring. It would be very inspiring. So now, if you were here with us last week, you know that we're going to be in Matthew chapter 22 this morning, Matthew chapter 22. And last week, and really what we've been doing is asking ourselves, what is important to us? What should we live by? What should guide our lives? And this is an important question for us to look at because as we walk throughout our lives, everybody that we encounter is either asking these questions, or they have already sort of found a tentative answer and they're now living by them. What's important to you? What should drive your life? What should guide your life? What should our lives be about? And last week what we did, we were down in verses 34 through 40, which we'll read here in just a moment, and we were looking at what Jesus answers when he's asked, what is the greatest commandment in the law? Because we think this may have some sort of bearing on what should be most important to us. And the reason why we think this is important to study is, first of all, because our lives, we believe, and I believe, our lives would be disorganized and chaotic and maybe unhelpful and exhausting until we discover it. Until we find some sort of organizing principle, some most important thing to live our lives by, we'll constantly be in a state of chaos. I don't even know when this was. I think this was like a few months ago. Madeline and I, we drove to Tulsa to see Jordan Peterson. He was speaking, and a few other of our guys went. We met up with Justin and Carrie and went. And however you feel about Jordan Peterson doesn't really matter. But one of the things that he had said when he was up there is he said, you know, there was a research study done, or a group of scholars had written a paper in which they discovered that if you had like 20 books, that there was an infinite amount of ways to organize those books on the shelf, right? Because you could organize them by like author's last name or author's first name, or you could organize them by like alphabetical order in the like third word on the second page of the, you know what I mean? There's an infinite amount of ways to organize these books on this bookshelf. And until you decided upon some sort of organizing principle to guide your life, what you would find is that you'd start to put the books on the shelf and then you just take them off and then you put them back on the shelf. And our lives are the same way. Until we discover that thing that is most important until we discover what this greatest commandment is, this organizing principle, we'll be unable to sort of organize our lives and figure out how we're to live. And so it's a question that we have to ask ourselves. And the second reason that we talked about last week as to why we need to answer this question is because the longer we live in our world without answering this question, the more we will find that the people and the institutions and the things that surround us will try to answer this question for us. Isn't that right? Last week, we bounced back from this passage into Deuteronomy chapter 6, which Cambry read for us this morning. And it's a passage from Deuteronomy in which the Israelites are about to enter the Promised Land, right? This whole big sermon is supposed to encourage them and get them set in their ways before they enter this Promised Land. And one of the reasons why Moses feels it's important to tell them all of the stuff before they enter is because they're entering a land that's filled with all sorts of rival gods, all sorts of things that are going to be vying for their attention, all sorts of things that are going to say, I am the most important thing, or I should be, and you should live your life according to me. And our world is like that. If you've ever, just this last week at MSU, they have this, and actually Sarah was a part of it, they have this big day where like all of the students, all of the freshmen especially, walk through and you see all of the booths of all of the clubs and all of the things that you can dedicate your time to. And if you are willing to, you can give them 40 hours if you want, or 60 hours, however many hours you want, right? You can dedicate your whole life to something. And unless you move into this space, and unless we move into our lives already determined and already decided that we are going to live our lives the way that God would have us to live them, and make God our organizing principle and our most important thing, we are going to be vulnerable to giving our lives to things that don't deserve our time and that don't have our best interest in mind. And so, friends, it's important that we answer this question. What is the most important thing? What's the most important commandment? What's the greatest command? And so, last week we talked about the greatest command. This week we're going to talk about the second greatest command, which would be a little bit maybe less exciting, second most. But regardless, it's going to be, I think, hopefully a beneficial study. So if you would, turn over to Matthew chapter 22, and we'll have it up here on the screens as well. But when the Pharisees heard that he being Jesus, had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. Teacher, he said, which is the greatest commandment in the law? And he said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. This is an interesting response. It's an interesting answer. And today what we're going to look at is the wholeness of the answer, the meaning of the answer, and the weight of this answer. First of all, let's look at its wholeness. So what do we make of this answer here? And when we ask this question, what we have to... sort of the conclusion that I come to is if we're going to have an understanding and figure out what to make of Jesus' answer, we have to figure out and try to understand the question a little bit. And it's a weird question. It's a really weird question. So if you look in chapter 22, what you'll discover is that this passage here, this verse 34, and following, it comes at the end or towards the end of a long line of interrogation. So back in chapter 21, Jesus was teaching in the temple courts, and scribes and Pharisees were asking him questions, and then he goes on this little spree where he's teaching, and he's teaching all of these parables. And then, when we get to chapter 22, after the parable that we see at the beginning, we get several questions that arise, where people are trying to figure out who Jesus is, and they're grilling him. And Matthew is very specific about the nature of these questions, that these are not inquisitive questions, that these are questions to test, and these are questions to trap. Right? And so, first of all, it begins with a political question. They want to know Jesus' politics. And so the Pharisees go and they ask him up in verse, beginning verse 15, they ask him if he pays taxes, right? They ask him what his relationship is to the government, right? And he says, render to Caesar's what is Caesar's, and render to God what is God, what belongs to God. And what we read there is that everybody there is just baffled, right? And they marvel at this, and they go away. And then the Sadducees decide to ask him a question, and they ask him a theological question, right? And they're asking him about the resurrection, and they're just making up this incredibly complex and intricate story to try to poke holes in Jesus' belief in the resurrection. And he swipes it away. You know, he deals with it very swiftly. Right? And at the end of that, everybody is astonished there in verse 33. They're astonished at his teachings. And so Jesus, he's been grilled by everybody around him. And so far, he's stood up to that. And our passage begins, when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. And then they ask him, which is the greatest commandment? And this is so strange. And it's so strange, I think, because it's a bit of an obvious question. It's a bit of an obvious answer. It's sort of a softball question, I think, and we'll get to that here in a second. We'll get to it now, actually. And let me tell you why this is. Now, the passage that Cambry read for us at the very beginning of our service this morning and the welcome was Deuteronomy 6, beginning in verse 4. Hear, O Israel, this is what's known as the Shema. And what we find is that Jesus answers partially from this command. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. These words I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk of them when you lie down and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hands, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gate. This is an important teaching. It's known as the Shema. And what we know about this time is that in this time, a devout and pious Jew would have recited this passage two times a day. Two times a day. And not only that, but they would have had this passage, this great commandment that Jesus brings up and answers with, they would have had it written on their doorposts. And in chapter 23, in verse 5, after this, whenever Jesus is referencing, he says in verse 5, chapter 23 in Matthew, they do all their deeds, he's talking about the Pharisees, they do all their deeds to be seen by others, for they make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long. What he's talking about there are leather straps that the Pharisees and the most orthodox and devout Jews in the time, they would take little boxes and they would put this passage in it, and they would take leather straps and they'd wrap it around their arm, right? And they'd tie it on their head, right? They would wear this passage with them, right? This was the passage, right? And so as the Pharisees are asking him, teacher, what is the great commandment in the law? They have the passage that he answers with written on their head, right? And on their arms, right? And they have it written on their doorposts, and they recite it twice every day, right? And in my guess, and I'm not for sure because I'm not a first century Jew, but my guess is that if you would have asked anybody, you know, in the synagogue or in the temple, hey, what's the great commandment? They would have given an answer very similar to the first part of Jesus' answer here. So it's a softball question, right? It would be like, and this is, you know, we're getting into political debate season, right? It would be like if you had a political candidate, right, and you would just grill them with questions. They're doing an interview. You just grill them with questions, and they'd answered everything perfectly, and then you'd said, okay, how about this? How many stripes are on the American flag? you know, it's like, and here it's a much more important question, but it's such an obvious question, you know? Like, what's the great commandment? Maybe it's the one that we have wrapped around our head, right? But what's interesting about Jesus' response here is not that he gives the right answer, because at first he does give the right answer. He gives the obvious answer. He gives the expected answer. But then he goes and he gives them something that they didn't ask for, which was the second great commandment. You notice that they don't ask for the first two, but he gives it to them anyway. He says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. Oh, sorry, go back. Sorry. This is the first great commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And this is interesting because he doesn't stop with the expected answer, but he gives a holistic answer. He gives an answer that will, I think, challenge them. And what we find is that Jesus is constantly doing this stuff. He gives them the answer that they're expecting, and he gives us what we expect, and then he gives us something else that challenges us. And for the Pharisees, a people who were devout, right? But a people, as we read in Jesus's, especially in his woes to the Pharisees, in his woe to the Pharisees here, a people who frequently forget the people around them, this would have been the answer that challenged them. What he gives them is a holistic response. And I want to point out the importance of this, because a church who listens to only verse 37, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. A church that does that and doesn't listen to the second great commandment is a church that knows all the answers, and that's a church that loves God. But it's also, and maybe you've seen this, it's also a church that can get quite cold. And it's a church that can become irrelevant and unhelpful. A church that sets its mind on loving God but not paying attention to anybody in their community, right? That's not a whole church, right? That's not both of these combined. And on the other hand, and we see this, pop up in several different places. If you look at the famous introductory chapter of Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 11, God says, "What to me is the multitude of your sacrifices? I have had enough of your burnt offerings of rams and the fat of well-fed beasts. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or of lambs or of goats. When you come to appear before me, who is required of you, this trampling in my courts? Bring no more vain offerings. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath and the calling of convocations, I cannot endure iniquity and solemn assembly. Your new moons and your appointed feasts, my soul hates. They have become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing them. When you spread your hands out, I will hide my face from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen." The state of God's people here, right? They're sacrificing in the right way, they're worshiping in the right way, but they're not worshiping in the right way, because what we find, especially in the prophets, is they're ignoring the way that their faith gets lived out in relation to other people. Sure, they're worshiping in the right way, and they're loving God in some of these ways, but they're not loving people. And in chapter 23, back in Matthew, we see this in verse 23. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin, but you have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others." Right? They're really, really honed in to this first part, but they were not concerned with the way that their faith got lived out in relation to their neighbors and other people. And so he gives them a holistic response. And on the other hand, and we see this sometimes, a church that only listens to verse 39, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself," without paying any attention to verse 37, "You shall love the Lord your God." Those groups exist as well. We see that in the great rabbi Hillel. He's a famous rabbi who is existing around the same time of Jesus. And there's a point, there's an old story, a famous story, where a man goes to Hillel and he says, "Great Rabbi Hillel, please explain to me all of the law and the prophets while I stand on one foot." Right? In other words, explain to me everything about your religion and make it snappy, right? Which I think we can relate to. And what he says is, do not do to your neighbor what is hateful to you. This is the whole Torah, and the rest is simply commentary. Which sounds really like pretty, and it's nice and snappy, but it misses the point, right? It pays too much, maybe, attention to the back end of this. And the problem with that is that a group of people, a church, and a person who pays attention only to the last half of this, they're extremely relevant, they can be extremely popular, they can help a lot of people, but they will also leave people wanting. Because I believe, and I don't think this is wrong, people have needs, but they have a deep need to know their Lord. And that there are ways that God heals people that people just can't do on their own. And if we are a church that is only focused on like loving our neighbor without also being in tune with the way that we love God and having a relationship with Him, we're out there and we're relevant, right? But we have no power to really be able to heal people and to help people in the way that God calls us to do. And so what we find here is that Jesus isn't interested in giving people what they want to hear. He's not interested, and I've often questioned why the Pharisees ask him this, because it is a softball question. I think they know the answer, and they're comfortable with the answer. They're ready to hear, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. They're on board with that. That's great. But the second part, they're lacking. And when we approach Jesus, He is unwilling to give us just what we're comfortable with. He wants us to become a whole people. He wants us to embody all of this as individuals and as a church. And so as we approach this passage, one thing that we learn is that we have to be a congregation and a group of people that loves our God and is willing to, that we are a group of people who are willing to inconvenience ourselves for God and love Him with everything that we have, but that we don't just lock the doors, but then we go out and that we love our neighbors and we inconvenience ourselves and our lives to those around us. And because we did the first thing and allowed it to inform the second thing, that when we move out into our communities and into our neighborhoods and into our families and into our workplaces and into our schools, that we have the power to actually heal people, right? In the deep, deeply human ways that they need to be healed. Right? All right. That's the holistic nature of his answer. Now let's look at the meaning of his answer, and these two will be shorter points, I promise. The meaning of the answer. Now, we're going to look at the second part here, down in verse 39. The second is like it. This is the one that they didn't ask for. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. This is challenging for a couple reasons. First of all, because of the quality of the love that we're supposed to have, the quality of the love. Love your neighbor as yourself. And the great commentator R.T. France, he says something that I think is helpful here. The text assumes, surely realistically, that it is normal to love, i.e. to be concerned for the interests of oneself, and that such love generally takes precedence over the interest of others. And so in other words, what he's pointing out, and what Jesus is pointing out here, is that we are, all of us, deeply aware of our needs, right? Most of our needs. And right now, perhaps you're feeling hungry, maybe. And if not, maybe by the end of my speaking you will be hungry, and I will have to run off stage. And when we're hungry, like, we feel it, right? You have that, like, gut feeling. And sometimes, like, it makes you feel a little bit sick, and you're like, you really need something to eat, and you quickly go and find anything, right, to fill your body with and to meet that need. And what Jesus is pointing out here when he says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, is that I should feel my neighbor's hunger with the same passion and to the same degree and with the same magnitude that I feel my own hunger. That I should be that in tune with the needs of the people around me. That when they have a need, I know, right? I know. Because I've done the work of thinking about, of talking with them and understanding who they are and then trying to imagine what it's like to live in their world and then knowing them well enough to know what sort of environment they live in and what sort of circumstances they might be up against. And I should know the needs of the people around me. And that is true. One of the people in this room, that we should be in tune with our with each other's needs, but also the people outside of this room. And that's a difficult thing. We need to be in tune with our neighbor's needs and to move forward to meet those needs with the same energy that we would meet our own. Right. The second reason why this is such a challenge is the direction of this love. The quality and the direction. Love your neighbor. Now, we've talked about loving our brothers and sisters before. We did that quite recently, but what's the difference between loving our brothers and sisters and loving our neighbors? Well, when I say neighbors, all of you probably think something, and all of you probably think something differently. Because some of you here in this room, you hear, love your neighbors, and you think maybe of a terrible neighbor that you had, and you go, ouch, I don't want to do that, right? And some of you have had really great neighbors, like the kind of neighbor that'll bring you, like, you know, like fudge, you know, Christmas, that sort of thing. And some of you, if you're like Madeline and I, you don't think anything at all, because you don't even know your neighbors, right? We have had, Madeline and I, since we've lived in that house in Stratford, we've had three different people live right across from us, which is crazy. And there's something about that. Now, this is not necessarily true of this context, per se, but this is what I thought of as I started to think about this. Neighbors are people, for one thing, who can be quickly in and quickly out of our lives, right? Which means the love that we pour into them sometimes feels wasted, right? Because one moment they're living across the street from you, and then you see the U-Haul truck, and then boom, new neighbors, right? A fresh set of people to love and to pour into that we may never see the fruits of. But second of all, as we start to think about this word neighbor, what Jesus is referring to are sort of everybody that's around you. And in this case, in this Jewish context, that could mean like fellow Jews and just people that you have to live with on a daily basis, but it could also mean the people that live in your community that don't believe the same things that you do. And because they don't believe the same things that you do, they act in ways that make you uncomfortable. And in some cases, even, this is their neighbors are the Romans that are occupying their nation that they believe should be independent. They're the enemy. And so what we find is that when Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself, what he is referring to is the fact that our neighbors range from the people that we come across in our life, including those who hate us, including those who will never return the favor of our help, right? From the small interactions to the large ones, that these are just the people that populate our lives. And the reason why this is such a challenge, even when our neighbors aren't our enemies, the people that we hate or the people that we have a difficult time loving, is that, man, that's exhausting, right? It's exhausting. Because how am I supposed to be, like, tuned in with the needs of the people that I work with in the GA office, right? It means I have to talk to them, right? I have to talk to them frequently, and I have to, like, know what's going on in their life, and then I have to, like, think about ways that I can inconvenience myself for them, and that's exhausting work, right? It's hard work, but it's the work that we're called to do, and it's the kind of work that makes an impact. Now, I'll give you an example of this work. You may know this if you've taken a world history class, but Christians living in the time of the Black Plague, the Black Death, is that right? Black Plague? Yeah, okay. That didn't sound like coming out of my mouth for some reason. Black Plague. Okay. The Christians living in Europe during the Black Plague, many of them, and this is noted by like several historians as something significant. Many of the people living in these cities refused orders to evacuate their cities in order to stay back with the people who had the plague, to keep them fed and to keep them taken care of. And if you think they got out of that work without getting sick and dying, you're absolutely wrong. But it's this kind of love for people that they were not connected to, other than the fact that they were fellow human beings. They stuck around at great risk and eventually at great cost to themselves and put their lives on the line in order to keep them fed and in order to meet their needs and to keep them as comfortable as possible until they reached the end. That's inspiring work. And those are our, those are our brothers and sisters, right? And so what work will we do? What work will we be remembered for 600 years from now? In what ways will we put our lives on the line for the people around us in ways that will be remembered for a long time and make an impact? I think when we do that, we can rest in the fact that it will make an impact. Because for those Christians who were hanging out in those European towns and getting sick and dying, I'm sure it felt like their lives were just being like snuffed out and they were going to never be remembered. There was just going to be a whisper. But here we are, hundreds of years later, still talking about them. This sort of love makes an impact in our world, and it's important that we live it out. The last thing here, and we'll finish up, and I want to conclude with this: the weight of the answer. The weight of the answer. Look at verse 40. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. Now, what Jesus is saying here is that sort of the whole message and the whole thrust of the Bible can be summed up in these two, and they rest on these two. Because for Jesus, his Bible was arranged not as we have it arranged, but in the form of the Tanakh. So you had the Torah and then the prophets and then the writings. And so when he says the law and the prophets, he's referring to the whole. And he says that the whole thrust of our mission as followers of God can be summed up and then can flow from, and they all bear on these two commandments. Everything else in the law, everything else that constitutes a Christian life, it depends on these two. And what I think Jesus is doing here is he's giving them a standard for success. And so it's important that we pay attention to it. Sometimes we have competing standards of success. And when we do, things can go quite poorly. And I'll give you an example of this. I'm currently taking a Hebrew class at Missouri State. And I went to class the other day, and I'm sure this person is a great student outside of this class, but there's somebody that asked the professor, he asked, are there any questions over the content? And somebody raised their hand, and they go, hey, just to clarify, what's like the lowest possible grade we can get on this class and still move on to 102? Which is like a very disheartening thing to hear from your classmates. And so, like, this person, they have a standard for success that was then obviously different from the standard of success that the professor had for people, right, and for his students. And when you have rival standards of success, you focus on different things, right? In this case, you focus on doing the bare minimum to get you through to the other, the other class so you can finish up and you can get your BA and everything will be fine. And sometimes when it comes to assessing our congregational health, we have different standards of success, don't we? And what I would put forward to you is that if we believe in this, and we can, we'll actually stay here. If we believe in verse 40, on these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets, and if we believe that verses 36 through 39 then become our standards for success, then it means our standard for success is not how many ministers we have on staff. And it's not how many elders we have. And it's not how many people we have in the building. And it's not the songs, and it's not the contribution. It's not any of that. And although some of those can be indicators of where we're at in our health, they're not the standard of our success. They're not the end goal. And I think, at the very least, what we can do as a congregation is if we can focus on these two commandments: you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. If we can focus on these two, then I think we can, and if we can put everything we have into following these two, then we can trust that the rest will follow. I believe that wholeheartedly, that when we become a holistic congregation that follows God in this way, I believe the rest will follow. I really, really do. What should our focus be as a congregation? We should ask, are we a group of people who are individually getting better at inconveniencing our lives for God? Are we as individuals and as a group loving and serving the people around us even when it hurts and expecting nothing in return? And if we can answer those in a positive way, and if we can work towards answering those in a positive way, I think we'll be in a very good place. If you would like to start that work today, if you've begun that work and you would like to renew your commitment to Christ, or if you would like to begin that work by putting Christ on in baptism and living for Him, we'd like you to do that by coming while we stand and sing.